Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. Jessica Anya Blau is insatiably curious about people. The author, who splits her time between Baltimore and New York, credits that curiosity with leading her into conversations and situations that sometimes inspire her books. Jessica is the author of four novels: The Summer of Naked Swim Parties, Drinking Closer to Home, The Wonder Bread Summer, and most recently, The Trouble with Lexi. Jessica talked about unlikable characters, feeling like an outsider, and her unlikely path to becoming a published author. Here's our conversation. What was the first book you fell in love with as a child?
Oh, wow. Well, there's so many. I think Madeline by Ludwig Bemelman.
That was my favorite too.
Really?
Yes.
What was it? I love that book. And then I named my first daughter Madeline.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh,
and then
goodness.
I always loved Paris after that. It was like just those images and the Eiffel Tower, and they walked through the Luxembourg Gardens. And so I loved Paris, and I loved the name, and I loved the book. And I was always a small kid, and she was small.
Have you been to Paris?
Yeah, a few times. Yeah, I love Paris. My brother was living there for a while, so that was incredibly nice for me because essentially I had a place to stay there, but now he's in Amsterdam.
So did you fall in love with reading early on? Have you been a lifelong reader?
Yeah. I mean, my dad is an English professor, and so he was in graduate school when I was born. We were living in Boston, and, you know, at the time when he was in graduate school, they were pretty poor, but we were in a house full of books, you know, and there were books everywhere, and both my parents are huge readers, but my mother hated reading to us, and she used to say, I hate reading to kids, but my dad loved reading to us, so from the youngest age, you know, we were read to every day. I have an older sister, so I was always he was always reading what she wanted to read, and I was the kid in bed, you know, I remember him reading her Chronicles of Narnia, and I would fall asleep. I just couldn't stay awake just because I was so young. And so the next night there would be these huge gaps in the story because she would stay awake and he would keep the story up for her. So I remember that book, just hearing it in pieces and having to figure out in my head what happened between the time I went to sleep and the time they finished reading.
So that was before you could read yourself?
That was before, yeah. And then as soon as I could read, I mean, he still read to us. And as soon as I could read, I was reading myself. And then, you know, in just hilarious dad fashion, he was constantly handing me books that were age inappropriate, but of course I would read them. So I remember reading The Painted Bird when I was just way too young to read it and just being horrified. And even reading Catcher in the Rye before I understood certain things about boys and men, and just reading scenes in that book and thinking, I can't believe my dad gave me this. But so I was always a reader.
That's one of those books that you definitely miss a lot the first. I think most people read that book before they totally get everything, right? That was my experience also. And you go back and revisit it, like, oh, totally missed that.
Yeah.
So it was one of those families where nothing was off limits.
No, nothing was off limits at all. I mean, that's for sure. There was no, if you wanted to read it, if you wanted to see it, if you wanted to do it, you could do it. There were no safety guards. There were no parental controls or, you know, on anything. And, you know, and then there were just walls of books in the house. And so, you know, I'd go in and, you know, I always read. And if somebody didn't hand me a book, I'd just cruise the bookshelves and pull a book off and read it. Or I'd go up to my parents' room when they weren't there. I mean, you know how when you're a kid, your parents' room is always somewhat fascinating and mysterious to you, or at least it was to me. I mean, it's like this weird, it's the strangest place in the house. Like the house, as a kid, you know, every room in the house belongs to you except your parents' room and their bathroom, if they have a separate bathroom. And so my parents' room with their bathroom was just like this place when they weren't home. I would go in and I would, you know, I'd look in the drawers in their nightstand, and I would go in the vanity in the bathroom, and I'd look in the drawers, and I'd look at my mother's makeup and jewelry, and I'd go in her closet and I'd try on her clothes. And there were always stacks of books at either side of their bed. And the books on my dad's side just never interested me. I mean, you know, he was you know, who's a Miltonian scholar, and, you know, and he read Paradise Lost, and he was just always reading these things that never interested me. But on my mother's side of the bed was, well, The Happy Hooker was there. I remember, you know, reading that, or The Diaries of Anais Nin were always there. And I remember it was like, I don't know how many diaries are in that series, but it felt like 1,000 to me as a little kid trying to read those, and I was so young. But they were still fascinating to me, and I would pick those books up and just try and read them. So there was always some kind of reading. We lived in Southern California, and 3 newspapers came to the house. And so there were always like stacks of papers on the dining room table. And so, you know, when you came in the house, you know, I'd come home from school with my friends and you'd sit down and eat. Do you remember that? There's always
You always have to come home and have the immediate snack.
Eat. Yeah. It's like, I don't know what it was about school, but you were starving when you got home. And so we'd come home and we'd sit at the dining table, we'd eat, and there were always these 3 papers and we'd read. There was the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Santa Barbara News Press. So I grew up with all 3 of those papers filling the house every day. And there were certain sections that I liked of each of them, that I would only read these certain sections. So there was just always, you know, it was one of those houses.
Were your parents eccentric?
They, well, I guess they didn't, I mean, yes. I mean, I wouldn't really think of them as eccentrics, but, you know, they grew up in the 50s, and my mother grew up on a ranch in Vermont with, you know, on 5,000 acres with hunting and fishing, and her father, who kind of hated everybody. And then my dad grew up in a row house in Trenton, New Jersey, in a Jewish neighborhood. And, you know, my grandfather, I guess it would be fair to say he hated the Jews. And my father was a Jew. And the first time he met, when my parents told him he was getting married, my grandfather said to my father, well, where are you going to play golf? You know, and of course, my father had never played golf in his life. He grew up in a row house in Trenton, New Jersey. And he said, I don't know. And he said, well, you can't play at the regular clubs because they won't let you in because you're a Jew. And you can't play at the Jew clubs because my daughter's not a Jew. So where are you going to play golf? So this was, you know, these are the 2 people who raised me, was this guy from New Jersey and this woman from the ranch. And then they came together and moved to Southern California, where they both sort of liberated themselves from everything. And we were 3 kids who sort of ran wild, and, you know, there's a lot of sunshine, and there was eucalyptus trees, and there was a lemon orchard in the backyard, and yeah, you know, and they were naked, and they all their friends would get together and have these naked swim parties, and, you know, we would sit there in our bathing suits, and I would just be as sort of fascinated and repulsed by the grown-up naked human body as I was by The Happy Hooker or Anais Nin.
Well, this is answering one of my questions, because I was curious how autobiographical or not autobiographical a lot of your work is. And I just read Drinking Closer to Home, and I'm hearing a lot of parallels in this. So would you say, I mean, how, to what extent would you say your work does draw from your real life experiences?
I mean, a lot. I mean, the first book, The Summer of Naked Swim Parties, was sort of loosely based on my childhood. And it started with a childhood memory of being at one of those parties with my parents and watching one of their friends on a diving board, a man, jumping up and down, and watching his, what kind of words can we say here?
We have the explicit tag on the iTunes label, so
we can say
anything. Feel free, yes.
Okay. So there was this memory of watching his, like, penis and balls fly up and down together, connected. And, like, I didn't realize the human anatomy and that they were actually connected parts. Like, I just, you know, I didn't really quite understand them. And so that was this really distinct memory of being sort of fascinated and repulsed by this. And so that memory started the whole book, The Summer of Naked Swim Parties. But it wasn't, you know, some of it was autobiographical, some of it wasn't. The loss of virginity scene where she, you know, the guy says, okay, I'm totally going to do it now, I love you. And then he starts doing it to her on the beach and she vomits in the middle of it. That was autobiographical. That was how I lost my virginity.
Oh, no.
On the beach, and I threw up right in the middle of it. And then we got back to it, though. We stuck with it.
Very persistent.
Yes, yeah. If I've got anything, I've got grit. So, you know, so there's stuff in there that was autobiographical. And then with Drinking Closer to Home, it was sort of like, why not tell the whole story or the real story? You know, why not fill it in and tell all of the stuff that was going on, you know. So I, you know, in Naked Swim Parties, I eliminated my little brother because I thought, ah, it's too many characters. And so with Drinking Close at Home, I threw my brother in there, and then my mother and my grandparents, the my Jewish grandparents, and then my rancher grandparents, and, you know, and I just threw the whole family in there. I mean, certain things were toned down to make the story better, and certain things were heightened, although really not much was heightened. It was more, you know, so, you know, and then things were rearranged in time. Like, there's the scene in Fire Island where Emery decides he's gay. They realize Buzzy, the father's having an affair. The mother decides she's an alcoholic, and Portia is pregnant. And all of those things did happen in real life, but they didn't all happen at once at Fire Island. So there's this sort mm-hmm. of like compression of time to make narrative tension in Drinking Close at Home. So there's a lot of, and there's stuff that, there is stuff that isn't true. But it's, there is plenty that isn't true, but it's a mostly true story. So before, you know, with books, there are, you know, you revise, and you get copies. Once it's going to be published, there are many times when you can change things. And then there's the last time where you can change anything. Whatever you put in goes in the book. And before that last time, I sent the book to everybody in my family and just said, you know, it's not any of them. It's not an accurate portrayal of any of them, but it's based on them, and it's inspired by them, and it's a version, it's a fictional version of them. So I want to make sure they were okay with this. I sent it to everybody in the family and said, if there's anything you don't like, you can take it out. And my mother read it, and she said, oh, I love the mother. She's great. I love it. And my sister loved it and said, ah, it's fun. I don't, you know, you definitely had fun with the character of me. My sister is such a good person because I just trash the sister in this book. I mean, she does such wild, radical stuff. And some of it my sister did, and much of it she didn't. And she was like, that's fine. Don't put it in. Although she was an undercover cop who did narcotics. That's
true. A really interesting, fun part of the book.
Yeah. So she did do that. And my brother, who, you know, he's sort of the least wild character in there, but, you know, he's gay and he has a coming out. And there's his gay loss of virginity and his straight loss of virginity within the book, both of which, the gay loss of virginity wasn't in the book originally. And the editor's like, can we just have when Emery, or maybe the straight, both of them maybe, can we have when Emery loses his virginity? We have, you know, blah, blah. And so I wrote my brother a letter at the time because I was like, what was it like when you first had sex with a guy? And he wrote me this really long 2-page single space letter describing it. And it's kind of weird to imagine your brother having sex.
Right.
But because I was writing a book and I had created him as a character in my mind, I could separate him, the person, from him that. So I put, you know, so I kind of changed it. So most of his stuff is actually pretty accurate. And he read it and he's like, yeah, it's great. I like reading it. And then my father, who, you know, is still teaching and working all the time, just didn't have time to read it. He said, I don't have time to read it. Well, what does it say about me? I said, well, the character who's like you has an affair. And he said, how many affairs? I said, one. He said, one? He said, that's fine. I'm getting away with a lot here. Or, you know, something like right. that. Like, yeah. You know, I was like, okay, yeah, that's good. So they were all fine with it. And as I said, it certainly isn't them. It's a fictionalization of my memory. But many of the facts, if you touched on them, are actually exactly true.
Well, and that's one of the benefits of fiction, right? You don't have a responsibility yeah. to the truth, but you can be informed by it.
Oh, absolutely. It's so liberating. I mean, it's so great. You're like, eh, we'll throw everybody in Fire Island.
Right.
And then the Wonder Bread Summer is sort of based on my life when I was a student at Berkeley. I was working at this clothing store. I mean, I was super poor. I was there for the summer. I had no money. I needed a job. I met this really kind of suave, great-looking, well-dressed guy at a bar who said I could work at his clothing store. And so my friend and I went to work at the clothing store, and no customers ever came in. And he would pay us with cash out of the register, and we just kept working, and nobody would come in. And then he would try and pay us in cocaine. But I was like, I need money. I got to pay rent. I'm hungry. And it turned out he was this major cocaine dealer, and that it was just, the whole thing was just this front for this cocaine dealership. So the Wonder Bread Summer was based on that summer and some of the crazier things that happened in Berkeley, including the quadriplegic porn producer, who is based on somebody I met who asked me to be in a porn movie in Berkeley who was a quadriplegic. And so it was, you know, and he was a really interesting kind of nice guy, actually. So that one's sort of, you know, that, and then it all, you know, a lot of fiction in there. And The Trouble with Lexi is fiction, the latest one. I mean, it's, you know, somebody told me a story about something, and it was such an interesting story that I had to take it and run with it and start the story with it. And the story came from a guy who showed up at some event where I was speaking, and the security guards were, you know, really upset and worried about him because it was some event you had to RSVP to and you had to pay money to go to. And I guess they did security. It was in D.C., so they did security checks on everything. And this guy had just come out of prison. And so they were panicked and freaking out about him. And I thought, you know, and then, you know, I saw him across the room and I thought, you know, he looked like a nice guy. He looked like Ryan Gosling in a suit. And I thought, well, what, he came out of prison. So what? So I went and talked to him. I was trying to talk to him. You know, I didn't want him to know that I knew he just came out of prison. But I was trying to find out why he was in prison just through, you know, what have you been doing the past 20 years or whatever. You know, I was just trying to get him to tell me. And finally, he did tell me why he'd been in prison. And he told me he had been addicted to drugs. And he said, and he'd stolen some drugs from somebody. And then he said to me, well, the problem wasn't so much that I stole the drugs. The problem was that I took the drugs where I stole them and then fell asleep on the bed of the owner of the drugs. And just that image, when he said that, seemed so compelling to me that I started The Trouble with Lexi with that image, with a woman. And, you know, I mean, I have sympathy for people who are addicted to drugs and get to a point where they do something that they're you know, that they feel is humiliating or shameful. So that book was from that. Drinking Closer to Home is my family. Wonder Bread Summer was when I worked for the cocaine dealer, and Naked Swim Parties is, you know, being in
that
high school.
One image.
Yeah.
So if that's interesting, because I guess your kind of career arc or the arc of these books has gotten more fictional over time. I mean, why do you think that is?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, really, once I wrote Drinking Closer to Home, I mean, I pretty much had processed my family for, you know, my parents' generation, their parents' generation. You know, I pretty much have processed the family history that I didn't, it's not that it didn't interest me anymore, but in a way, it's like once you do that, you know, it's time to move on. So it's always, you know, for me, the writing has to be mysterious, and I don't want to be, I mean, if I'm bored, the reader's going to be bored. So it has to be just utterly fascinating and interesting to me. I mean, writing is so hard. I mean, there's absolutely no way you want to do it unless you're writing what you want to write or what you're interested in. So, I mean, I guess once I'd really thought through my family and the family dynamic and the crazy childhood and the unparenting that happened, and, you know, once I'd looked at all this stuff, my brother's bird who flew free in the house and then shit all over the couch.
Oh,
was
no.
Like hard white crust on the back of the couch, and my parents naked, and the drug, you know, the marijuana and it, whatever. I mean, once I'd looked at it all, it was like, okay, now, you know, now it's time for something else. So it was constantly, I'm just moving into whatever I'm interested in at the time.
Are you, just with the Wonder Bread Summer, that reminds me of writers who, you know, actively seek out kind of like crazy experiences because I can write about this one day, or the young writers who, you know, something bad happens to them and, you know, everything is copy Nora Ephron, I guess. So I wonder, your childhood and your somewhat eccentric parents you didn't have any control over, but are you a person who has sought out kind of crazy, interesting experiences in your life in service of a story?
I mean, I would say I've never sought out anything in service of a story, but I definitely have an incredible curiosity about people, all people, and it tends to lead me into strange situations because, I mean, my curiosity is endless. I'm in New York half the week now, and I ride the subway, and I almost can't stand it that I can't come up to certain people and just start asking them questions about their lives or who they are or what they're doing or why they're wearing what they're wearing or sitting with who they're sitting or where they're coming from. Or, you know, I mean, I just, you know, people will catch my attention on the subway, and I just, it's like I kind of want to know everything about everyone. And all people are interesting to me. So I think somehow that curiosity gets me to places. Or things just happen. I mean, I had this guy, this naked book club guy who wanted me to come talk to his naked book club. And, you know, there was just no way I was going to go naked at a naked book club. But it was, my curiosity was like, yeah, well, how's that going to look and how's that going to work? So I, you know, I went. And it was totally fascinating. When I got there, they were doing naked yoga. Book club happened after yoga. And
naturally, as it does.
You're right. First naked yoga, then naked book club. And it was a hilarious night. I mean, just walking in on naked yoga, it was like a woman teaching, and there were about 20 naked guys in the class. And when I peeked my head in, they were doing downward dog. I mean, naked downward dog with men is just like not something anybody ever wants to see.
No.
I mean, it's just so bizarre looking. You know, the male form moving around like that isn't the same as the female form moving around like that. So it was just, you know, it was just an interesting experience. So I think things do happen just because, you know, I don't know, maybe because I'm curious. And also, I'm kind of always thinking I'm about to die. So I, even though I have like anxiety and panic attacks and multiple fears of endless things, I do try and see a lot and do a lot and experience a lot just because I think this is it. I've got to, you know, if I'm going to do this, I have to do it now. So I'm always open to seeing, thinking, hearing, you know, somebody will say, let's, whatever, anything. I will always go and try it.
You seem like someone who is comfortable being uncomfortable. Is that fair?
Yeah, maybe that is fair. Yeah, that's a good analysis. I've never heard that. But yeah, that does seem right. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm not, people don't freak me out. I mean, situations freak me out and I can get scared. But, you know, I just find all people interesting. And so, yeah, certain people will, things will be uncomfortable. And I don't mind being an outsider. I've always sort of felt like an outsider. I mean, when I was a little kid, you know, I didn't have any friends. And my only friend was this old woman. Because kids seemed so bizarre and ridiculous, like when I was five and younger. And so I hung out with this 70-something-year-old woman, Mrs. White, and she was my best friend. I had no friends, and except her, you know, because she would talk and she wasn't doing strange things. And then we moved to California. I had this pack of friends, but, you know, we were the weirdos. I mean, it was like everybody in the neighborhood was like white, Catholic, Christian people, and we were like the Jewish people from the East Coast with the, you know, mother smoking pot and the dad, you know, reading Paradise Lost. You know, we were just like the weirdos in the neighborhood. So I never fit in. Everybody else's house was clean and perfect and they had gardeners. And we were just like the messy, chaotic house. So I was always the outsider. You know, I don't think I've ever felt like an insider. And even in Baltimore, I've been here years. And it's such a cool, interesting place. I mean, it's just totally fascinating, but I never feel like an insider. I always feel like I'm an alien looking at Baltimore. So I think I'm comfortable with that position in life.
What do you think feeling like an insider in Baltimore would look like or feel like? Like, what is a Baltimore insider? And now I laugh because that's the name of one of our blogs on the site. But yeah, what do you mean by like feeling like an outsider in Baltimore?
You mean all these families who are, you know, they're here, their mother's here, and their aunt's here, and their, I mean, you meet in every neighborhood. It doesn't even, you know, whether you're in Hamden or Guilford or, you know, I mean, it's just all these multiple generational families that know each other. And then they're just, I mean, even the Raven, I like, the thing I like about the Ravens is that, and maybe the Orioles too, but the thing I like about sports in Baltimore, because I grew up in a house where the only sport that was ever watched was tennis. And so I didn't really know sports or understand it. I don't know, you know, I don't know the names of teams. But the thing about the Ravens and the Orioles is that no matter what neighborhood you're from, what you look like, you know, what your economic situation, like, this city unifies around sports. And it's like in cheering for the Ravens or the Orioles and just being part of that, it seems like a real insider Baltimore thing. And I can sort of fake it. Like, I can watch the team, and I do want them to win. I want them, but it's almost like I want them to win for everybody else in the city. It's like, oh, I really want them to win so that all these people in this city can be so happy. But there's something about, you know, that, and then there's the horse races, which I don't even get or understand. You know, and so I have two daughters who I've raised here who I guess. I mean, one of them doesn't seem like a Baltimorean. I mean, her father lived in Canada, so she would go to Toronto for the summers and, you know, and be here. But the other one, you know, she'll go to Preakness or something, and I'm thinking, I'm just like, I'll be driving her and her friends to Preakness to drop them off, and I'll be thinking, who are you people? And why are you dressed like that? And what is with those high boots that you're wearing? And why are you coming home covered in mud and drunk? And, you know, I mean, it's like, I just, like, there's all these rituals here in different places and in different ways that everybody seems to get but me.
It can be very hard to penetrate. I've noticed that, too. It's kind of like this us against the world mentality. And I think there can be an embrace of outsiders who embrace Baltimore, but also a little bit of, like, keeping them at arm's length.
Yeah. And it's fine. You know, I mean, like, they have each other. Like, the thing I see here is that people, they have each other. I mean, there's, like, huge families and there's huge generations. It seems really nice. I mean, it seems incredibly comforting and nice. And I mean, even crabs and Old Bay and, you know, I mean, there's just all this stuff. And I don't feel like I have any of that in my life. I mean, my parents left their families and left their sort of tribes and created their own small tribe in Southern California with us, where we were just this isolated weirdo family. So we didn't have this extended tribal thing that I see here that looks really nice to me.
Do you still have any family in Southern California?
Yeah, my mom's there, and, you know, she's in her house, and my sister's there, and then my dad's in New York now, and my brother's in Amsterdam.
Do you remember when you knew you wanted to be a writer, or knew that you were a writer?
So I didn't realize I was a writer, but I kept diaries compulsively from the time I could write. I mean, you know, I always had friends, and even my own daughters, I would give them journals and diaries, and they would write in them for 2 days, and then there'd be, like, you know, completely empty. Both of them. And it used to drive me mad because I'd keep giving them to them, and it was just, like, empty, empty, empty. So I was the person who was filling those diaries, and it was constantly writing. And so I was always experiencing my life while floating outside of it and observing it. So I was always had a certain amount of detachment in my own world, in my own life, and I still do. It's like sometimes I have a hard time not being detached. Like, I'll be somewhere and I'll realize that I'm floating in the ceiling observing it and that I'm not present, and I'll, you know, I'll say in my head, like, be here, like, stop narrating this and be here. So I have to bring myself into reality, or I'm just this ghost, you know, watching everything. So I look back now and realize I've done that my whole life. I mean, they're just diaries just filled and filled and filled. I mean, every year, on and on and on and on, and all the way through. And I didn't study writing, and I was always reading and writing these diaries. And it wasn't until I moved, the first story I wrote, I was in the buyer's training program for a very fancy department store in San Francisco called iMagnon, which no longer exists. And, you know, I'd work, and the people who worked in this industry were just totally fascinating and bizarre. And at iMagnon in San Francisco, I was the only, I was on this one floor, and I was the only American on the floor, which also made it really interesting. And there was a French woman, and there were some, yeah, I remember there were the Canadians who would just never say they were Americans. Everybody thought they were Americans. They would point out constantly they're Canadians. And there was the French woman, and there was the Russian woman, and there was the Greek woman, and there was the Chinese woman, and there was just, like, all these. And it was so interesting. And so I wrote two stories, and I also lived in Oakland at the time, in a semi-nice neighborhood, but I would be in a really bad neighborhood when I, you know, went to the post office or anything like that. And so I wrote two short stories when I was working in retail, and one was sort of about my neighborhood, and one was about where I was working at iMagnon. And I just did it on my day off, like, just somehow I got this impulse, and I just wrote these stories. And I didn't show them to anybody. I didn't talk about anything. And then my then husband and I moved to Canada, and I couldn't work, and I wasn't allowed to work, and I wasn't allowed to go to school, and because I could have gone to graduate school or something. I wasn't allowed to do anything. I just had to stay home. And I was incredibly isolated and lonely. I mean, he was at this corporate job, and I'm, like, all alone in Canada. I got married really young. I got married, you know, I married my college boyfriend, and we had a baby really young. So he brought me home a computer from work, and I just started writing every day. And then I realized every day when I wrote, everything was okay. The day was okay. It was, you know, it's like I felt productive. Like in the meantime, I'm like a housewife. I was cleaning. I was keeping the garden neat. I was doing all the things my mother hadn't done as a kid. It was like the house was perfect when he came home, and the lawn, you know, looked like it had been, you know, it was just every blade was the same height. And so I was just doing all this stuff, but then I was writing every day, and it felt really good. And I just wrote, and I'm reading just constantly. We didn't have a television. And I was just reading and reading and writing and writing. So I essentially was teaching myself how to write without realizing it. And I wasn't sending stories out. And I wasn't doing anything with them. I was just reading and writing and reading and writing. And just every day, pages and pages. And I don't know what I was thinking I was going to do with it. I have no idea. And reading. And then I wrote one short story that I looked at it and I kind of thought, like I sort of gasped. I thought, oh, maybe somebody would publish this. I had this weird idea. And nobody knew I wrote except my husband. And sometimes he would read some, but other than that, nobody read them. And so I sent that one short story out to one magazine, and they published it. And I thought, oh, what is that? You know, it was just totally shocking. It was like, what does that mean? And then I thought, well, maybe I should go to graduate school and write. And so it wasn't that I decided I wanted to write, and then I was writing. It was almost like I was writing compulsively and then realized what I was doing. And so it was the realization that almost allowed me to say, I want to write. It was like, I am writing and I want to write.
Did you feel like creatively or professionally fulfilled before you started publishing writing? Is it the kind of thing where you would have been totally happy to go along working in retail? Or when you started writing and getting published, was it that kind of cliche, the thing that clicked for you?
It was, I was going to write whether I got published or not. And because any writer you meet who is published has written 10,000 times as much as you see. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, so you see these four books, but I've written so much more because there's just no way to do it without doing it, and you know, and nothing will come unless you just keep doing it and keep doing it, because it's rejection and failure are part of the process. So I did do it in spite of anything. I would just keep going and keep going and keep going, you know, and you'd hang on to those good rejections. I remember I kept getting handwritten notes from the New Yorker, like I would save them thinking, it's handwritten and it's personal. It's actually, you know, so you kind of.
It's almost like an acknowledgement. Like even if you're rejected, it's like someone sees me in some way, I guess.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was like, it's not the form note. It's like, this is so. And I was getting them from the Atlantic too. And it was just like those, you know, and I'd be like, okay, well, it is an acknowledgement. So you just keep going and keep going and keep going. So I guess I would have, yes, I would have kept writing. I feel incredibly lucky and grateful that it was published. And I just keep going. And there's still the terror and the fear and the insecurity. I'm working on a new book now. And it's, you know, I mean, I still sit down and think, oh, my God, am I going to be able to pull this off? Like, will I be able to make this something great? And so I don't know if I have any more confidence than I ever had. But I do it as much as I can, in spite of the fear, in spite of the terror, in spite of the insecurities, I still sit down and just do it. And so I think that's always how it's been.
What can you tell us about the book you're working on now? If anything.
Well, I do have the title is The Memory Wife. So that's what I have.
Yeah. And that's it? We're leaving it at that? Yeah.
Yeah.
If you think back to when you were writing your first book and when that was published, what didn't you know then, and what ended up surprising you about that process?
I mean, I didn't know anything. It was like the whole thing, you know, when they took it, I remember my agent calling me. I was just like sobbing, like calling my mother and sobbing. It was just so like I couldn't believe it. And then the whole process, everything was a surprise. I didn't know anything. It was like, oh, we do that, you know. And then book tour was a surprise, which I love. And I've gone on tour with all my books, and it's so much fun. It is totally terrifying to me, you know, because I have a fear of speaking and, you know, all these things, but I do it and feel, and I love it. Like, love meeting booksellers and bookshop people who are always incredible. Librarians who are incredible. So it was all surprising. You know, and then the first book, you know, when they picked it for the Today Show for their summer list, I remember just thinking, everything was just stunning to me. What I didn't know, one of the things that I couldn't imagine what I didn't know is the access it gives you to other writers, which is kind of great. And just to books. I mean, I get books sent to me all the time, and which I love, you know, and I get to read books and read them early. I mean, so those are the two things that I didn't realize. Those are the two perks that I didn't realize you get, is you get lots of books sent to you, which is nice. And you get to meet all these other writers. And writers, as a group, I think are pretty incredible people. They're insightful, and they're funny, and they're smart, and they're usually pretty self-aware. And, you know, as a category of people, I tend to love them all.
I've seen on Instagram people taking photos of an excerpt from a book or a particularly well-designed cover, and they'll hashtag galley brag because it's, you know, out before the book. And I have to say, I'm jealous of the galley brags. I'm not at a point in my life where I'm getting any galleys, but I guess you're in that elite class now.
Well, I didn't realize there was a hashtag galley brag, but yeah, galleys are fun. I mean, one of my favorite writers, Willie Vallanton, I just got a note from his editor about 2 days ago. And said, hey, Willie has a new book coming out. Do you have any interest in reading it? And it was like, I felt like screaming at the computer, like, are you kidding? I love this guy's books. Like, of course I want to read it. You know, it took a lot of control not to put like 15 exclamation points in my reply. Like, yeah, send it right away. So, I mean, things like that are nice. Like, you know, and then you get to meet people too. I mean, you just go places and you get to meet these people and hang out with them. And I, you know, few writers have disappointed me when I've met them in person. It's like, as I said, yeah, I mean, I actually like all people. It's hard for me to find a person I actively dislike. I do think all people are interesting and have something valuable, or maybe all but one single person in the country today. But I tend to like all people. And writers have low boundaries, and I have low boundaries. I'm trying to, you know, I try and work on, you know, because I teach, and it's like boundaries, just, you know, I got to remind myself to have boundaries. But writers have no or low boundaries. And so I'm very comfortable with low boundary people. You know, I'm very comfortable with people who just expose themselves immediately and that kind of stuff.
I read that you ghost wrote a memoir. Is that true?
I did. And it's funny because when we were talking about Drinking Closer to Home, and you said, well, it must be nice with fiction, you can say what you want. That was a lesson in, you know, I mean, I ghostwrote, it was first person. So, you know, I collaborated with the sister and the person whose story it was. So it was two sisters. And so the three of us collaborated. But it was first person, you know, so I was putting myself in the mind of this person. You know, and we had diaries and yearbooks, and the one sister who's a lawyer had police reports and social worker reports. And I mean, she was like a paperwork fact fanatic. She had everything. You know, so as I said, when I ride the subway and I want to get in somebody's head, this was the ultimate experience of actually being with a person and being allowed to ask them anything I was curious about. Like, there were no limits because I, you know, we're working on a first person memoir. And so I had to fully understand everything, even if it didn't go in. You know, so, I mean, to write a scene where we're going to obscure some facts because somebody's alive, I still needed to know the whole scene in order to know what I'm obscuring. So it had to be that nothing was obscured to me or hidden to me, just so that I could write it properly so that the reader would understand fully without maybe revealing certain things. So it was that freedom just to get into somebody else's life and feel their life and feel their head. But the one sister who's a lawyer, she wanted everything triangulated. So it's like we'd have the memory of the woman whose story it was, and I might write it down. And then she'd want to make sure that there was either a police report or somebody else was there who confirm it, or it was in her she kept diaries, which was so great. I mean, so we had years of diaries where she's writing down all this stuff, or it was in the diary, or it was, you know, so there was all this stuff of keeping the memory exact. She didn't want anybody to be able to doubt anything. And so it's this really intense, wild story. The name of the book is Girl Unbroken, and it's the story of Rosie Maloney. And, you know, her father was in the mafia, and he was shot in the head when he came out of prison, and her mother was an alcoholic who physically abused her and her siblings, I mean, in just terrible, massively physically abused them. And she was in a foster home where she was physically abused, and then she was kidnapped out of the foster home by her mother and taken to Idaho, where she was won in a poker game by a Mormon farmer who then abused her, and then she was kidnapped from Idaho by her sisters in New York who wanted to get her away from the abusive Mormon farmer. I mean, it was just like this incredible story, and it's all true. And she's this unbelievably warm, loving, kind, good person. I mean, she had the shittiest life with multiple people abusing her along the way, and somehow inside her, she has this just incredibly peaceful, calm, loving center that survived all this. And I think it was through the love of her sisters. She was the youngest, and so she was just adored. So, I mean, she was just, it was a really interesting experience working with these women and their memory and the story. And it was great. It was fast, though. We had to write a book in like 2 months. And then, you know, and then we revised it in 3 months.
Is there a part of that that's difficult to, you know, contribute to writing this and not have it be a Jessica Anya Blau book?
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting. It was an exercise in ego. I mean, you know, the cover, when they were doing the cover, it was like, I don't have a say. Like, I was hired just to do my part. Like, I don't get a say in the cover, in the title. It's like, they would always ask. I mean, I'm talking about two incredibly kind, great women. But even the contract, it was with HarperCollins. And it's like, contractually, all I could do was what I did. And I wasn't allowed to be like, I hate this title. You know, I mean, I was just, it's like I had to accept it. And then I went to a couple of their events in New York, and sitting in the audience and you know, people would ask questions about it, and they're talking about the book, and it was sort of like, you know, I'm this hidden force in the audience. And it was, I think it was good. I think it was a good experience. It was like, you know, I mean, the ego is a terrible thing, and it just gets us in trouble, and it creates this horrible sense of yourself in the world. And it's just, I mean, the ego just screws you every way. It's like an absence of ego is so much easier. It's like your feelings aren't hurt. You don't take anything personally. You can just exist within yourself and move forward and create and love people and do what you want. And like, ego just messes up everything. So I'm constantly trying to eliminate my ego because it's problematic. It's problematic for everybody. So, but this really forced me to do it, to sit in an audience and hear people talking about this book or praising it, and just to think, I can't say anything. I don't get any credit. And it was good for me. Now, I have to point out that I was working with two women who are incredible. So at some point, at all the events where I was when I was having these feelings, one or the other of them would be like, Jessica's here, you know, and they would point me out, because that's what they were like. They certainly didn't have to do that, and they did, and it was always incredibly sweet. But it was a strange experience. Yeah, and the book was in People magazine. You know, is there a People magazine pick? And I thought, I didn't even feel the right to say something like, my book. It's not my book. It's their book.
When you write your books, do you have a particular audience in mind? And what would you hope that readers of your books, you know, take away from them or think about them?
I don't have an audience in mind. I'm definitely writing what interests me at the time. So I guess I'm my audience. And I hope, I mean, first of all, I think a lot, you know, I teach writing too, and I think a lot of people lose track of the fact that I think, for me, it should be entertaining. And so I always hope that anyone picking up one of my books would be enthralled and entertained, and that they would enter the narrative dream and leave their own lives and have however many hours it took to read the book where they were floating in the mind of someone else, and they got to leave their own life for a while. I mean, because that's what I want in the books I read. And so I hope people have that experience of the full, rich experience of being in someone else's head in their life. But I'm not trying to teach a lesson there. I'm not trying to make a statement. I'm not saying anything about politics. Each of my books is talking about a particular person a single particular person doing things. I mean, the trouble with Lexi, she, you know, I think of her as a really good, kind person, and she gets in trouble. And I'm not saying anything to anyone. We all get in trouble. And we all make stupid mistakes. But it was like, what would it be like to be this person who messes up, who's good and kind and loves people and just messes up so badly?
That actually kind of leads to something I was curious about. In fictional narratives, I paradoxically love an unlikable character, whether it's TV or novels. And I think it could be argued that, I mean, your characters are complex and maybe not all good or bad, but I think some people would say some of them are unlikable or difficult to like. And I wonder if you're also attracted to characters like that in your stories, or what you kind of think about people who just want all of their, you know, their characters to be very likable.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. It's interesting. I mean, first of all, in my life, I've done so many stupid things. It's just unreal how many idiotic decisions I've made and dumb things I've done. And so I can pretty much forgive everyone anything. And then even, you know, my students will do something or whatever. And I remember being that age and doing that some stuff. It's like, I can't separate myself from these experiences. I can't. So I never feel like I could say to anyone, like, you're an idiot. You know, I might say, like, well, I hope you learn or whatever. And we all learn. So my characters, I actually don't find any of them unlikable. Like, I think when I'm writing them, I love them all in spite of their flaws or in spite of their poor decisions. I mean, the trouble with Lexi, she's really trying to do good and to be good. And she makes them, you know, she starts having an affair with the wrong guy. And then she starts taking too much Klonopin. And then, you know, things spiral and she's completely wasted and does something stupid. I mean, I've been completely wasted and done something stupid. I don't drink or do drugs or anything now, but I have done really dumb things. So I think for all of them, I love them all in spite of their flaws and the things they do. And I accept that some people find them unlikable, but I do wonder. And I know there are, you know, there's so many people that are smarter than I am and wiser than I am. And I think that many people go through life without doing a bunch of stupid shit. But I didn't. And so I'm always sympathetic to that. So I get why all the wiser, smarter people would be like, why would she do something so stupid? But to me, they're all likable. I mean, they're all versions of me. But when people don't like them, I do accept that. And I certainly don't take it personally. It's like, I mean, that's the ego. It's like, you can't, once you write a book, you got to let that go and not take anything personally what anybody says about any of it. It just exists. And all those thoughts and opinions exist outside of it.
To you, what is the power of a story and the role of fiction in our lives?
Man, you have good questions here. I think empathy and feeling love for people, I mean, it sounds sort of corny, is sort of all there is in life. And the power of a story is the power of being empathic and feeling love for people who aren't like us. And, you know, and there are characters we hate and there are bad characters, but even that, in feeling empathic and understanding how and where they're bad or why they're bad, I mean, even that, entering into a bad character, you know, Lolita or something, I mean, it's still an interesting place to be. But I think the power to feel other people's lives is a great, the power and the ability to is a great thing. And I think books, you know, good books allow us to do that.
Jessica, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great talking to you. PT, she a dope girl, dope girl, dope girl.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with author Jessica Anya Blau. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find Female Trouble everywhere you listen to podcasts, like Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. It would really help us out if you subscribed and gave us a rating. You can find more on Twitter at FMLTrouble and online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. Dope Girls! Dope Girls! Dope Girls!